Hello and welcome to Spotlight on Transitional Justice, the podcast series in which we explore the relevance of transitional justice concepts for societies involved in ongoing conflict and especially with a focus on Ukraine. Today's episode will focus on the role of media and communications in these processes, and our guest is Ricardo Corredor, who is the Center for Journalism Studies of the Los Andes Universities, former executive director of Gabo Foundation, an illustrious producer of different television programs and a long career in academia and journalism. But most relevantly for this conversation, he's the former head of communications for the Colombian Truth Commission. He's played a vital role in how media and communication strategies were used to make the truth-telling process in this commission more accessible. And we'll dive into the complex role that media plays in transitional justice and how it can shape narratives that help or hinder societies dealing with the past. This is an area that especially interests me, due to my background and interest in transitional justice. Ricardo, this podcast is envisaged to illuminate, as I said, different transitional justice concepts, primarily for audiences in Ukraine. For this purpose, I think Colombia is a country where transitional justice efforts were implemented during the conflict, under different governments and in various forms, from criminal justice, reparations, truth-seeking. But I think that the approach that gained a special dimension after the peace agreement between the government and the FARC rebels in 2016 is something to really explore in this conversation, as it comprised the Special Jurisdiction for Peace, the Truth Commission, where you were deeply involved, and the media played a very important role in how these processes were perceived in the Colombian public. As we know, media can play a very constructive role where it creates a space for dialogue, facilitates the dissemination of truth, but at the same time it can be a tool for disinformation, manipulation even. And in your experience, what have been the most critical ways that media contributed to the transitional justice process in Colombia?
Well, thanks for the invitation to talk about these issues. They are very relevant around the world and still very relevant here in Colombia. I would say several things. So the first thing is that the people that, you know, when we're involved in transitional justice processes, we tend to forget, I guess, somehow, what the word transition means and how long does it take and the dynamics that are behind it. For some reasons, I still believe that in our heads, we still think about transition as something that is simple and fast, somehow. And it's all the contrary. It's not simple, it's very complex, and it's not fast. It doesn't have to be slow, but it depends on the dynamics of the local context. So I think we're going through what I would say is understandable and acceptable in terms of a transitional justice system. You know, this doesn't, you know, it's not like a cut through moment where, you know, things stop and then another thing start, you know, like from anew. So we have here dynamics that are, you know, part of the dynamic of transitional process system, which is, you know, some of the people that signed the accords backed off, you know, and say, you know, we don't agree with what's going on. So we have some, what we call here, disidencias, I guess in English will be dissidences. So a small part of the former FARC guerrillas that went back to the fight. Small group, but still a group that can, you know, create some violent situations in very specific parts of the territory. But the other thing that happens in Colombia is that we had several different dynamics of violence. And we had one main part of the source of the violence was, of course, the FARC guerrillas. They were the largest group and the oldest group, in fact, in Latin America. But there were some other groups also present, especially another guerrilla group called ELN, ELN. There was a group that was relatively small compared to FARC. FARC at the top of the war, they were around 25,000 army soldiers. It's difficult to estimate, as you know, it's very difficult to know exactly. But let's say ELN, it's about 2,000, something like that. So it's not as big, but it's not a tiny group. And they also are creating different, you know, dynamics of violence in different parts of the country, very specific parts. But we also, as you know, is one of the peculiar dynamics of the Colombian situation is that we have still drug trafficking as an incredible fuel of violence, an incredible fuel of resources, of money and resources for violence. And we had, you know, some of the Mexican groups now are present in Colombia and very actively involved. You know, so at this moment, I believe it was the Red Cross, if I'm not mistaken, or United Nations that said that we have at this moment about 7 or 8 local wars going on. So that dynamic, what I'm saying this is because that context makes it difficult for a narrative of transition and a narrative of peace. Because, of course, what media does is when those acts of violence are committed by these different groups, and they are different in nature and in different in their purposes and in differences of what they want to achieve with their violence. But in terms of narrative, it creates a narrative that the situation is still not close to peace. But if you look at what happened in the last 10 years when the peace agreements were signed from 2016 to today, you can see clearly that the situation is getting better in many, many different areas and in different indicators. But because recently there has been, you know, a dynamic of conflicts created by these different groups, media has to talk about this, you know, and said there was this confrontation between the army and ELN in this place, and then there was this massacre that was happening in another part, was created by the Clan del Golfo, the Gulf Clan, which is a Mexican group, you know, so that doesn't help at all in terms of creating this idea of a transition, or that we're moving towards peace somehow. But I think there is a challenge here.
Let me ask you, sorry to interrupt you, but let me ask you, should media play an active role as an actor in the process, or is it simply an observer that is there to report on the reality without having any responsibility for actually, let's say, building a culture of accountability, building a culture of against impunity, advocating for victims' rights in circumstances of this nature, or especially when it comes to highly polarized societies that are either in conflict or are just out of conflict.
Yeah, I think there is a role that is a little bit more than just an observer, and it has to do with the fact that from which standpoint they are observing. And I believe, for instance, that media in this case should give more perspective in terms of what a transition means and what a transition implies, you know. And it doesn't mean that they don't talk about what's happening now, but I think it will be important to explain that what is happening now has to do with the dynamics of a transitional process system that is taking place. And I would not like to say that they present this as a normal thing, because I think that would be problematic. I would say like, oh, yeah, it's normal, you know. I don't think that's the way to frame it. But it's different to say, you know, there are happening these things here, violence is here, deaf people again, massacres again, just like that, and not giving a perspective of what it means and what we have achieved for, you know, with the peace process, and what does it take for us to go through a process like this. And this, there is an additional context that it's important that I mention. We had a president 2 years ago that was a leftist president, and that was himself a part of a guerrilla group that signed a peace accord at the beginning of the 90s. So for him to be as president is an important, for me, I think it was an important moment in our history, because it was the first time that we ever had a president from the left in government, but also because he was a guerrilla member, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever. So for me, that was an important sign, you know, of what this is happening. But in a polarized society, I don't think Colombia is polarized, the whole country. I think it's the elites that are more polarized than the country as such. But politically, we are polarized, very divided. And the Edelman report of a year ago or so clearly put Colombia in one of the most polarized countries in the world. But in a context where there is a political divide, this also created a dynamic of confrontations, and the media played a role in these dynamics of confrontation, of what it meant for a country that someone like him is in power now. And you see some media that are playing the game of polarization is still talking to him as an ex-guerrilla member, or even some are saying a guerrilla. You know, we have a guerrilla fighter in power. You know, so those dynamics play a part. But he also, he's a firmly believer in peace, and he is a firmly believer in the peace accords and the implementation of the peace accords. But when he became the president, his policy in terms of peace, it's what he called total peace, paz total. And what he meant is that we are going to negotiate with all the groups that are using violence at this moment, even if they are not considered political. And that created also a very, very strong polarized dynamic, because some people were opposed to this in terms of, you know, as is commonly known, like, you know, you don't negotiate with terrorists, you don't negotiate with criminal groups. And he's saying, we're going to negotiate with anyone that is willing to negotiate. And at this moment, there is a peace commissioner, and the peace commissioner, the office of the peace commissioner, is in charge of, I heard this the other day, and it was really, and it struck me, because they are in charge of around 80 negotiations throughout the whole country. Those negotiations include the ELN, the guerrilla group, which is the largest one, but it also includes, you know, gangs in Buenaventura that are creating havoc in that city. But 80 negotiations, of course, most of them are very preliminary and exploratory, but there is about 10 of them that are in a real process of negotiations. Again, the ELN is one of them. The government is at this moment in a negotiation process with them, which actually was stopped about a couple of weeks ago. But that dynamic of the total peace created by the Petro government has also created, has fueled polarization very strongly. So I think media has a responsibility of course, of saying what's happening. But I also believe that they have a responsibility of going a little bit more beyond just, you know, reporting that the negotiation with the ELN just stopped and, you know, the ELN put a bomb here and that's why the government said that's it. You know, I think it has to give more perspective, and it has to give more perspective in the context of a transitional justice process.
Great. Let me then go back to your time at the Truth Commission, where you served as the communications director. And this is an issue that is particularly relevant to Ukraine these days, and that is the issue of disinformation and kind of media manipulation of what is going on, especially in the context of the mass crimes that are being committed. And this is a problem, as we can see, growing problem in the world, but especially in conflict and post-conflict societies. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in ensuring the integrity of the information being disseminated during the work of the Truth Commission?
There were many, many challenges. I think the first challenge had to deal with the fact that this was a long-standing conflict. We're talking about the war, the conflict with the ex-FARC guerrillas was about 60 years. So when you have a conflict that is taking so long, that also puts people, I believe, even more polarized. Any conflict polarizes a society, but when this has happened for so many generations, you know, this, I think it's deeper, the way it kind of like sets up in a society, because many things are not even conscious, and so many situations are normalized. You know, like we got used to the fact that the military will police the country. And it always surprises me when foreign people come, friends or colleagues or whatever, come from other countries. They are shocked to see the military going around normally, you know, in the cities or in the rural areas. And when that happens, you kind of like get like, what do you mean this is not normal? You know, because it's been for us. I grew up, you know, traveling around the country with my family when I was a young kid, and the military were all over. And you know, for me, that was normal, you know. And just when I started to work on these issues and talk to people and have foreigners, it's like, what do you mean? This is crazy. You know, so you get to tend to normalize things when there has been a conflict that has taken so long. That's one part. But the second part is that the peace process was polarized from the beginning and very polarized in our political elite. And when the president, Juan Manuel Santos, negotiated or started the peace process, the negotiation, he said that he will validate the result of the process with a referendum. And he did, and he lost the referendum. And that was a blow for the process because it meant the difference between the yes and the no was very, very small. But in democracy, they won. The no won. And I think that that really put a stress on the whole process, and it made the process, the birth of the post-conflict and the birth of the transitional justice system, it put a strain on it, political, a very political strain that we're still not over. You know, still people are saying, we don't agree with that process. That process is illegitimate because it was not approved by the referendum. Later, it was approved through another mechanism that Santos created because, you know, the international community in particular, they were very interested that this process will not collapse because of that. So they created another mechanism to validate the process, but that created kind of like, I would say, like an original sin for the whole process that's still dragging the situation here. So, you know, a long-standing process, a conflict, the fact that politically the referendum was won by the no, that those two things put very strong challenges for talking about peace and talking about transition and talking about the possibility of not living with an everyday violence as we had for so many years. I would say those two things were challenges. I'm talking about big ones, you know.
The context, yeah. But tell me, going back to your work at the Truth Commission, how did you navigate these challenges? And especially when it comes to disinformation about the work of Truth Commission. Also, today, social media plays a significant role in shaping narratives about the work of these institutions. So how did you navigate this balance between official channels of communication and the social media? Did you actually actively use social media to combat disinformation, or did you rely on other channels?
Yes. What you mentioned is very important. Today, when we talk about media, it's a new ecosystem. It's not what we usually have in mind. When they talk about media, people usually think radio, TV, newspapers. And this is not the case today. Those three media still exist, of course, as we know, but they are not as relevant as they used to be. They are not as irrelevant as many people would say, especially in the digital world. They want to dismiss as if, you know, traditional media doesn't matter anymore. It's not true. All the information that I gather, all the studies that I had, the research that I had access to, show, for instance, that in Colombia, radio and TV continue to be very relevant, especially in the peripheries. They are not relevant among young people. That is true. That is absolutely true. But they cannot be dismissed just because of that. But social media is indeed a new player. Not new, really. We're talking about 20 years. But they really are now a part of the ecosystem that is very relevant, and they have much more influence. And I would say even in some parts and with some certain parts of the population, they are even more influential than traditional media. That is true. So when I set up the strategy for the communication strategy, I understood that I need to work on all those fronts. So we have a front on traditional media, and we had TV and radio, and of course we work with the press, the traditional printing press, the digital. But we also had, and I had a very strong digital team. And it was a digital team comprised of young people, because this is a new language and a new dynamic. And even people like you and me that study that and that have been trying to approach this and embrace it, I still believe that it's different, our perspective, that someone 30 years old or less than 35 years old, which was my team. My digital team was people that were around 30, from 25 to 35. But also when you work with digital, when you work with social media in particular, you also need to understand that you need to have different fronts, because it's not just one social media. So we ended up working with four. We ended up working with Facebook, X at that time called Twitter, Instagram, and in the last times, because it really grew after 2020, TikTok. And you need to work with the four. One is just not enough, because they all, you know, are geared to different parts of the population, from the younger population. Of course, Facebook is more for people our age, for our generation, the baby boomer, the X generation in general terms. Instagram's more for millennials. TikTok is more for Gen Z. So you need to have like a spread out strategy. You cannot just, you know, kind of like lean on one part. You need to work on different fronts. So I had traditional media, digital, but we also had many different other fronts that we worked on. And I thought, you know, I was lucky enough that we had international cooperation support to do a lot of things in media. Because when you have to spread out a strategy so much, it's about a matter of resources. If we didn't have the resources, we had to like focus on one, and I would say that would kind of like cripple the whole thing. I had the advantage of having resources to do all that, but it's very demanding, because you have different fronts at the same time.
Let me ask you something before I come back to this, because it is very relevant to our colleagues and friends in Ukraine to hear it. Just the fact that you were actually hired, that you were able to work on a strategy for the Truth Commission. And I imagine that there are people who are working or worked on the similar strategy for the Special Jurisdiction for Peace. Speaks of the changing understanding of what communications role is in the mandate of these institutions. I myself have written about the challenges that this presented, because in the years, many years of transitional justice mechanisms, international courts, truth commissions, the understanding of communications was something that was on the margins, never part of the core mandate, really. But in fact, maybe with the exception of the South African Truth Commission, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Tell us about the experience, or your experience of being actually called upon to develop the strategy, and what was the view of the legal professionals and people that you worked with as far as communications are concerned.
Yeah, I think this is very, very important what you mentioned. And I think we at the Truth Commission were lucky enough that the commissioners understood that communication was important, and that communication was strategic and not just functional or operational, not just a service office to produce PowerPoints and to, you know, to publish documents and these kinds of things. It was more than that. And I think that made the whole difference. because it was clearly stated when the commission was set up that a communication strategy has to be put in place, and it has to be a communication strategy as such, and not just simply a communication office that will attend the commissioners, you know, and kind of like assist the commissioners in their, you know, everyday production of papers or documents or presentations or whatever. So I think that was very relevant. And I believe the other parts of the system, because the transitional justice system in Colombia has three parts. It had the Truth Commission that is already finished because it delivered the report. But it has the tribunal, the peace tribunal, the Jurisdicción Especial para la Paz. And it has another unit that's called the Unit for the Search of the Disappeared. Because one of the consequences of the conflict in Colombia and the number that the commission gave was about 110,000 disappeared in Colombia. It's probably double, but because it was impossible to register and to kind of like, but officially the commission talked about 110,000 disappeared. It's crazy. And so there was created this other unit that their challenge is to try to, you know, find these people, which is of course impossible because probably half of them are in the rivers of our country. But I believe the three institutions understand the importance of communications. So I believe that is important. And they also give resources for this. I still meet with the heads of communication, with the transitional, with the peace tribunal, and with the people from the unit from the disappeared. And I know that they are, you know, that their work is valued and is taken into account and is considered important. So I really believe that made a whole difference. But in the commission, and the Truth Commission, I think that was even more important. And even those other two organizations, the tribunal and the unit, they talk about the work we did as a reference, as a point of reference, because we really had a possibility to do many, many things, many different fronts.
Why is it, in your opinion, important that the public not only is informed or understands the process, but actually engages with transitional justice processes? And to this effect, why is the public communication essential to its success, especially when it comes to places where there are mass atrocities on the scale such as Ukraine?
I mean, because this is, as you said, this process, transitional system processes and peace processes, they are moved forward or they are, you know, destroyed or they are paralyzed due to narratives. It's certain narratives that makes it go forward or go back. I really believe that, and the documents from the international, from IFIT, from the one that you wrote and the one that you were involved with about narratives, for me that was very important and very relevant in understanding why this was so important and not just, you know, a lateral thing that we have to talk about because we need to inform. I think it's more than information that we're talking about. It's what makes sense. It's the narratives is what allows people to frame and understand. It's what allows the society to get a hold of what is going on, what is at stake, what is the challenge. It's more about information. Of course, information is the everyday vehicle that we work with. It's you know, it's our everyday tool, but it's more than information. And we understood that also at the Truth Commission, because we also had different four strategies were set up. Communication was one, but arts and culture was the second. And arts and culture, we worked very closely with them. There was a different unit, and of course, arts and culture is not communication in a traditional way. But we need to work together, and we did work together. And that was also very important. So that's why we also were involved with theater, with music, with artists getting involved, with the expression of artistic expression at the local level. So that was another strategy. And there was a strategy also that we called participation, where we really try to get people involved, especially organizations from civil society. And then we have education as another strategy. So those four strategies together made it even more strong, the action of the Truth Commission. And those were important because for you to help the country make sense of the process, it's not just traditional information and it's just not traditional media. You have to play a very different tactics at the same time. And those dialogues that we have with these other strategies, like arts and culture in particular, were very important. And I think it was important that the commission understood that there has to be a dialogue among them. And we work together, you know, and we create synergies together. And I thought that was part of the, you know, of the success that we had. Of course, I would like to have more success, more impact than we had, but I would say in the framework of what we did, we were considered successful in terms of communication, and that was part of it. This is because we also we understood that this was more about information. This was about making sense. This was about giving a frame for people to understand and to locate what was happening and what was at stake. I think, and that goes way beyond just simply information.
This is, I think, at the heart of the whole issue, and especially when it comes to the role of media. And I'll ask you a couple of questions before we kind of close it, this fascinating conversation. But transitional justice has one of the key goals in providing a voice to the victims of these horrendous crimes. How can media serve as a platform for victims and ensuring that their stories are shared in a way that is not exploitative, which is often a phenomenon that unfortunately plagues transitional justice processes reporting?
That's a very interesting question. One of the things that we discovered at the Truth Commission, we had two sources that for me were very relevant and very interesting. One was a work that some people were doing in terms of neuroscience, trying to understand what was happening in the brain of the Colombian population affected by so many years of conflict. And that was very interesting to see, because that gave us, usually when you worked on communications, you are very oriented towards the cultural way of how communication works. You don't as much deal with biological processes in your brain. So that was interesting, because those studies, and those were very preliminary, and I got a hold of them at the very end, but they were very helpful for when we were trying to disseminate the final report. But those studies from the neuroscience laboratory, there was a peace neuroscience laboratory at Javeriana University. And those studies show that one of the consequences of so many years of war and so many years of violence and so many years of tragic events was what they call a mental freezing of the brain. You know, one of the things that I learned with these people is that the science, the research about neuroscience has grown very much due to the new technological developments of scanning, of scanners, and these kinds of things. 30 years ago, it was very difficult to know what was happening in our brains. Today, those technologies allow people to, those science to understand what's happening in our brains. So that gave me a clue, you know, because it's not just about willing. It's not just about, it's not that people don't want to. It's not that people are not open to it. It's that there is something here in our brain that is, you know, that created this mental freezing. That's what they call it. So that, I thought that was interesting. But the other thing is that we had another research that was more from the cultural side. And that research from the cultural side that was based on this French guy that was kind of interesting, crazy kind of people, I thought. But it gave me some clues as well. And he worked with the framework of cultural archetypes, a little bit inspired by Jung, Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst. They did a very, very, very deep and interesting research about how Colombians deal with truth. And what they found is that in a very deep level, and that the whole research is that it's difficult to access those deep level just by doing some, you know, poll. It has to go more deeper than that. And they did. They did some dynamics and, you know, with games and, you know, these kinds of things. It shows that Colombians relate to truth, you know, at a very deep emotional level. They relate truth to fear, pain, fear and pain. So that was also very interesting for me to understand, because it showed that, and this is what's happening right now. We're seeing right now, because in the end, those two studies, what they say is that this will take a long time. This is not going to be easy. This is more deep than what we think. And that what we see from you know, from a superficial way. So going back to your question, is that these things have a more deep, profound sources in the people than we believe. We tend to see these things just from a rational process, you know, and from a rational standpoint, who doesn't want peace? You know, everybody wants peace from a rational standpoint. Who is interested in death and violence? But when you go deeper, you start to understand that there are other dynamics where violence and pain and these kinds of, you know, things that happen in a war, that is also part of the framework for certain parts of the population. That's the way they deal with this, you know, the way they deal with the differences by killing the other, eliminating the other, you know, suppressing, send them into exile, not wanting to see them. And that doesn't seem logical, but that's the way it is. You know, so I think it's important to understand when you talk about these things, that this is not just about rational thinking. And when you talk about narratives, and this is something also that those papers from IFIT talk about, those narratives are built around rational arguments. Of course, you have to explain, you have to say what are the benefits, you have to give the numbers, you have to give the data, all that. But you need to understand that there is also a very more deep cultural dynamic in there that you have to work with. And that's where storytelling is important. Because depending on the type of storytelling you develop, and depend on the stories that you worked on, and that you decide to put a focus on, that could lead the process to in one direction or another. And I still believe that we are very much based on the idea of a rational human being that is a rational person that thinks and takes decisions because of a rational framework. And I'm not saying that is not true. There is a part of it, of course, but there is a more deeper level that is more profound that we don't usually talk about. To me, just to close, I was reading at that time, and it was a very coincidental thing, I was reading the Daniel Kahneman book, Think Slow and Think Fast. Daniel Kahneman was this psychologist that died, actually, I think this year or last year, recently, that won the economics, the Nobel in economy, because he studied how the human brain works in terms of deciding in the consumption of goods and services for the economy. But what he said is that we have a brain that it's this, our slow brain that do the complex processes, and we have a fast brain that, you know, that also makes decisions. And we usually think that it's our slow brain that controls our mind, and is really the fast brain. When intuition and these other things worked in a very strange ways. So for me, that was very interesting because I understood, like, yes, of course. But you usually tend to build communication strategies for the slow brain, just to paraphrase Kahneman, when we need to understand that there is that it really works more efficiently and commonly on every day is the fast brain, where it's more intuition, is where more emotions, is where there are other dynamics. And if we don't think in communications, considering those dynamics, then we are just, you know, it's a formula for failing.
Let's close with exactly that. And let me, for the final question, ask you, considering what is happening in Ukraine, the fact that the conflict is ongoing and it's vicious, the Russian aggression is taking its toll even as we speak right now, what would be your advice for media professionals and transitional justice actors, because there are people who are looking into these crimes, who are looking into various different ways how to deal with this today and in the future, and beginning to navigate these difficult but crucial processes. How do they do their work of reporting or providing information about these processes to make sure that any reckoning with this is based on the truth, but at the same time to work to build a country that is hopeful, if you want, in dealing with these things, and one that relies on positive principles, like we said, accountability, victims' rights, reconciliation?
I mean, I'm not expert on Ukraine, so I would just be very careful in terms of what I'm saying, because I don't know. I mean, I try to read and I try
from
to
from your perspective, of course,
as much information as I can, but I want to just be, you know, I hate when experts talk about, you know, everything as if they knew. And but I worked in Colombia when the conflict was on, and actually you were invited to some of the, you know, seminars and workshops that we did when the conflict was still on. But one thing that I would say is the nature of that conflict is an international conflict in terms of the different to ours. We were, you know, a national armed conflict. This is an international armed conflict. And I think that that puts a, that that involves to think about another dimension that we didn't really need to think about, which is the international, you know, outside Colombia. Of course, we had, you understood that there was some, the international community, but that was not our main concern. Here, the way the world thinks about that conflict is as important as what's happening inside, because geopolitics are a very relevant situation here. So that is, that puts another level of complexity, because it's not just about what's happening inside. It's just not about reporting of what's happening in the different fronts of the war. It's about trying to communicate to the world and communicate to the powers that be about what's happening, how to move their understanding and their frame for understanding from one direction to the other. So I think that's one challenge, you know, how to get someone like me in a country in South America, but that it's worried about what's happening, and that, you know, it's part of a community that deals with peace, how to make me understand what's happening. It's a level of challenge that we didn't have. I mean, we tried to do a little bit, but it was not our main concern. Our main concern was local, national. Here you have to have a concern about the international level. But if you are in Ukraine, you have little control of what the narratives are built around the conflict. But those narratives have an impact on what you are doing at the local level. So I would say that that is one thing to consider. And that to me will, you know, put some challenges that are, make it more complex. The second thing that I would say is that, again, and this happened also to us when our conflict, our internal conflict was on, is that we tend to put a focus still on war, on the acts of war, and not on the acts of resistance and the acts of peace. In the Truth Commission report, which is 10 chapters and 24 books, but one of the chapters was about resistance and about resilience. Because what we discovered at the Truth Commission is that, of course, there was a war, and there was the stories of the horrific things that were done during the wars, those the human rights violations, everything. But there was also huge stories of people that did not go to war, that they did not accept at the local level that violence was the option, and they opposed, and in many cases they pay a high price. People, those many of those leaders of those processes were murdered. But it was interesting to see that chapter of the report telling on the incredible amount of peace processes and resistance processes and resilience that was taking place at the same time, and that I'm not so sure that when the conflict was on, we put much attention to those processes. And I don't want to sound naive, but maybe if we would have put more light on it, if we were put more spotlight on what was happening at the local level, and especially this happens at the local level. And because those are things that are not newsworthy, that's why the traditional media don't cover those things. But I think it's, if when you see what's happening at the local level and you see those dynamics, you start to see another things. I'm not so sure what's happening in Ukraine at the local level, but I'm sure there are people trying to look for peace and trying to do as many things as possible. And for instance, me, we're here, thousands of kilometers away, I don't know much about those. I just hear about the war. And this is normal, I guess, somehow, because the war is always more newsworthy than those local processes where people are saying, you know what, this doesn't come into our territory. But I think always to look at those, even if it's just for later, if there was a truth commission happening later on, just so we have the register, you know, we register those processes. And it's interesting to say, let me finish with this. Of course, when you look at the role of media during our conflict, you see many problematic things. But at the same time, we had to acknowledge that many of the sources that the Truth Commission used were news reported by media. So, because we were not in a very, we were not in a complete dictatorship and we were not under complete censorship. It was a different dynamic. But, you know, but those reports produced by the media were used by the Truth Commission. And many of those stories of resistance and many of those stories that we put on the report were based on media news that we gather. So even though maybe at this moment these things don't have the impact that you wish, maybe they will have an impact later on. So always focusing on those other dynamics that are around a war, a conflict like this one, are important to try to focus on and report on.
Ricardo Corredor, I will thank you so very much for your time and the insights, which I'm sure will be listened to with interest in Ukraine among our colleagues and professionals. If you have any closing thoughts, please be welcome. Otherwise, I thank you so very much for participating.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. And you know, these are, I have to acknowledge your interest in these issues and putting this, the relevance of communication in these processes. I think it's very important that people like you still continue to insist that this is just not a lateral thing, that this is strategic, and the narratives are at the core of what's happening in any conflict in the world.
Thank you, Ricardo.
Thank you.